Welcome to Path to Zero, the podcast about clean energy and the journey toward a low-carbon future. Your host is Tucker Perkins, engineer, entrepreneur, business leader, speaker, and clean energy industry veteran, who now serves as president and CEO of the Propane Education and Research Council. Now, here's Tucker.
Welcome to the Path to Zero. I'm your host, Tucker Perkins, and I'm very glad to be with you for this episode. With the guest I invite onto this show, I'm taking a journey through the complexities of the global energy world. I'm searching for conversations that help shed light on how we can move towards a low-carbon future in practical but pragmatic ways. Today, I'm pleased to welcome Dr. David Pellow to the episode. Dr. Pellow is the Delson and Department Chair of Environmental Studies and Director of the Global Environmental Justice Project at the University of California, Santa Barbara. This is the second of a two-part series on the topic of environmental justice, a subject that's of real interest to me because a low-carbon future, climate change, and environmental justice are so closely intertwined. Hi, Professor. Welcome to the Path to Zero.
Sure. Well, thank you so much, Tucker, for having me on your show. It's a real honor.
Before we jump all the way in today's conversation, I want to talk a little bit about your background. And I'm really especially interested in the commitment you've made to improving the living and working environments for people of color and immigrants, indigenous people, and working class communities. So, David, can you talk just a little bit more about your background and really what motivated you to concentrate your work and your career on environmental justice?
You know, I'm originally from Tennessee, from Nashville, Tennessee, so I'm a Southerner. And my beginnings, my origins in this field, this area of study and research and teaching and activism really begins with my parents. And those two wonderful folks, actually I would say three, because I got my mom, my biological mom, my stepmom, and my dad. They were all involved in activism in their early years. In terms of the environmental angle, that came about when I was very young. My father was quite the outdoorsman, and would almost every weekend we would be hiking, we'd be camping, we'd be swimming. You know, like I said, I'm from Nashville, and anybody who's visited Nashville, lives there, knows there's a wonderful lake there, Percy Priest Lake, which was just, it was like my second home. There was one moment where we showed up there, and we were getting out of the car, going to the beach, and I opened up the glove compartment for some reason. I was opening up the glove compartment to get something out of there, and I noticed there was a, shall we just say, a weapon. And I knew it was real. It wasn't a toy. And I asked my dad, I said, what the hell is going on here? We're not hunters. Why would you need a weapon? And he started to break down some of the history of racial violence in spaces of recreation that I was entirely unaware of. You know, I was probably, I don't know, maybe 11 years old. And it kind of ruined my Saturday. But I have to say, it opened up a whole understanding of how spaces of recreation, whether it be national parks, national forests, swimming pools, lakes, green spaces, are for some folks with cultural and economic and political privilege, places of relaxation where you don't need to have a care in the world. But for other people, they can also be spaces of violence and anxiety, because you're often not wanted there. And so that really opened up a whole new space for me to understand connections between inequality and environmental access, and access to clean environments, and who's able to get that access and who isn't. And so getting interested in environmental justice, you know, was something that was in some ways implanted. There was a seed planted there early in my life, and it's been flourishing ever since.
Boy, a relevant story, certainly from the lens of today as well. Thank you for sharing that. Yeah. As I was studying your profile, I see that you're working on a lot of things, but you're working on a book bringing together 5 dozen scientists and social scientists and humanities scholars, activists, to talk about the history of 60 key terms that have been used in the field of environmental studies. Fascinating work, but I'm guessing that you're really interested not just in how these terms were started, but really how their meaning has evolved over time. Tell us more about that work.
Yes, yes. And so I'll give you an update. That that project actually has come to fruition. And so I'm proud to say that, you know, we've got, even though we're just on audio, if you can see this, it's the book is called Keywords for Environmental Studies. And so I want to give a big shout out to my colleagues, Joni Adamson and Bill Gleason, who really took the lead on that and then brought me into the fold as the social scientist. Those two are more humanities scholars, environmental humanities scholars. But yes, as you said, we've got 60 keywords here, and they represent just an enormous range of concepts. I'm looking at the book now, and we've got agrarian ecology, for example. We have bioregionalism. We've got democracy, consumption, conservation, climate change, ecology, health, history, nature, place, and so on. I don't know if there's a good answer to that question, but a couple of terms come to mind that I think are especially relevant now that we do have covered in this book. And one is Anthropocene, or some people call it, pronounce it the Anthropocene. My dad's British, and that's how he might pronounce it. And, you know, there's this idea, of course, that, you know, this is this era, this geological epoch or epoch of human dominance and over all other species, over the planet itself, and how we need to recognize that, be aware of that, acknowledge that, and do something about it, because that seems to have created quite a crisis for us. Now we're in this sixth mass extinction, and some of us don't seem to be aware of or cognizant of that or willing to address that. One other that I've heard, not only in this book, but more recently with what's going on with COVID-19 and the racial unrest, is the term ecofascism. And I don't know that I can come up with a really nice pat definition of that term, but, you know, the idea, I think, is one where people, whether they're on the left politically or on the right, have been, I would say, accused of using ecofascism. And that is a way of mobilizing authoritarian ideas and maybe policies to advance an environmental agenda. That's another term that I think this book, which came out a little while ago, Keywords for Environmental Studies, is more relevant than ever.
Yeah, I look forward to reading that. Let's stay on the topic you were on just for a moment, where you really talked about kind of a climate change, which has really been its own movement. Now we have COVID-19 and a worldwide pandemic really making us realize about how human health and urban living, how that impacts our lifestyle and our health. And then finally now, you know, a complete racial movement and all that social unrest. How do you see those three things coming together to make a meaningful change going forward? How will they come together and be different? Or do you see it being different?
Yeah, no, I think that is perhaps the question facing us right now. I mean, in terms of urban spaces, as we all know, you know, as important as rural communities are around the world, and I would argue they're actually even more important than ever before, because they tend to serve as the primary resource base that fuels urbanization. We know now that more than half of the human species is living in urban areas. So we are, for better or for worse, mostly an urban species. And so we've got to deal with that as human beings. And I think in terms of how that intersects with questions and realities of inequality in general and COVID-19 in particular, you know, I've been thinking what we've got right now is this moment where we can go one of two ways. One way, and we're seeing both of these trends, right? These dynamics, where one is hyper-individualism. Damn it, it's my individual liberty and freedom to do what I want. I don't need to wear a mask. And it's not that I don't care about other people, but damn it, the Constitution says that I should be able to live my life without an overreaching government. And a big part of me agrees with that, absolutely. The problem with that, obviously, from a public health and an ecological perspective, is that scientifically, there is actually no such thing as an individual. I don't know that there ever has been. I mean, you know, scientists have pointed out that 90% of what we think of as human beings is actually non-human. Your body, our bodies are made up primarily of non-human beings and other objects and species. So we are symbiotes in every sense of the world. We are always connected to other beings. And so, it may be a cliche, but it's just true that we're one family. And I always say, you know, as much as I have disagreements with Donald Trump, he's family. And so I have principal disagreements with him, but he's family because we are all part of this same ecosystem. And so for me, a really positive thing that we could come out of this current crisis, the crisis of urbanization, environmental sustainability or unsustainability, racial unrest, COVID-19, is that, and this may be controversial, but I'll say it again, is that this idea of hyper-individualism, this myth of the solitary autonomous individual really does have to die. And what has to be reborn in its place is an understanding, a deep understanding of interdependence. And we're just coming off of the July 4th holiday, and many folks will say, Happy Interdependence Day, and that's what I say as well. And I think we should move beyond that and think of every day as Interdependence Day. And so that for me is a framework that would be really positive and helpful for thinking about how we relate to one another, how we relate to our earth, our life support systems, and how, frankly, we make public policy, whether it's energy, housing, healthcare, education, environment, et cetera.
David, one of the courses you teach is called Building Sustainable Communities. And as we prepare for other guests, we're really fascinated to talk about something called a regenerative agrihood. And the vision there is that it's a community that will fully sustain as many as 3,000 people, no carbon emissions whatsoever. A really cool vision. And our guest is going to talk a lot about the community and the physical structures and how it works. But my guess is that your view of a sustainable agrihood is much broader than the physical structure. So talk to us about your views of sustainable communities.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I would love to learn more about that. And I certainly support, efforts that are looking to move us toward the path to zero, to low carbon, zero carbon emissions. Yeah, I often grapple with what some scholars have called, the equity deficit, right? And much of the discussion and the thinking and the policy work around sustainability. And of course, that means, that so much of the focus on sustainability has been what some might in some ways critically call a techno fix, right? Well, let's just get the technology right, and then everything else will flow. But that's only, of course, part of the equation. The other part of the equation is of course, the equity component or the justice component. So in my class on building sustainable communities, I underscore to students, all right, let's look at, for example, hydroelectric power, which for many people is viewed as a sustainable source of power, right? You've got a river or waterway that's just producing power. Isn't that great? Well, what are some of the social impacts of that? And the many positive social impacts of power generation from a waterway. I just mentioned growing up in Nashville, Tennessee, and being able to swim in Percy Priest Lake, which was made possible by a dam. But people in these environments, these estuaries, riverine environments, fisher folk, they are often negatively impacted by that power generation. Their human rights are often violated when hydroelectric dams are built because people are dispossessed and displaced, moved out, evicted. Literally millions, tens of millions of people worldwide have been evicted for the cause of building allegedly sustainable hydroelectric big dams. Another example, of course, is solar power, right? When we look at what it takes, not just to power photovoltaic cells, but to actually create them, in many cases, we are talking about toxic chemicals and therefore an occupational environment, a working environment that where these products are manufactured, that's not always safe and could be improved. We could say the same about any other form of energy generation. The question is, what is the full range of impacts on various populations, both human and non-human, on our ecosystems and on our human social systems? And so I guess the last thing I'll say about that in terms of the class Building Sustainable Communities is I center justice in this class, because it's something that everybody cares about. We all may bring to that issue of justice very different experiences and maybe very different definitions. But I try to ground it in empirical studies and empirical research, and by demonstrating that, according to the best social science I've seen, we find that justice matters when it comes to sustainability and environmental issues for a whole host of reasons, one of which is that it turns out that justice and democracy and environmental sustainability seem to be closely correlated. So those cities, counties, and states in the United States, and those nations across the world that tend to have stronger democratic structures, policymaking that tends to be more protective of vulnerable and marginalized peoples and populations, those are the same communities that tend to have stronger environmental protections.
You use a term we'll come back to and visit in a bit, the full range of impacts, but I really appreciate the way you spoke to that point. So let's take a quick break. When we come back, I really want to talk a bit more about how environmental justice and low carbon future may intersect. Thank you.
Zero is a big number. Getting close to a future of zero emissions starts with using the broadest mix of clean, low-carbon energy sources. You might be surprised to know that propane produces a lot of energy for thousands of purposes and millions of people with virtually zero particulate matter, zero impact to the ozone, zero toxicity, and zero potential for storage-related contamination. It's low NOx and low CO2 to boot. Path to Zero is sponsored by Propane, Clean American Energy. Learn more at cleanamericanenergy.us.
Dr. David Pello is with me on this episode of Path to Zero. He's the Department Chair of Environmental Studies at University of California in Santa Barbara, and we're talking about the nexus of environmental justice with a low carbon future. Dr. Pello, we really haven't posted this episode yet, but just a few days ago, we had a colleague from the University of San Francisco on, Alice Kazwan. Have you, by chance, worked with her at all?
I have not had the pleasure, but I hope I can at some point.
Amazing person and really a deep thinker on a lot of these same issues that we're talking about, the intersection of climate and social justice and environmental justice. But we were talking a lot about the cancellation of the Atlantic Coast Pipeline and perhaps how environmental justice played a bigger role in shaping the development of now large-scale energy projects. You start to connect the dots, you see very recently the shutdown of the Dakota Access Pipeline, which had a direct connection to the Standing Rock Sioux Indian Tribe. You see the permitting tangle around the Keystone XL Pipeline, really, again, about indigenous people, the Rosebud Sioux Tribe, the Fort Belknap Indian community. And then now we see the Atlantic Coast Pipeline with a lot of objections, but certainly one was about its impact in siting compressor stations on rural, poor, historically strong, but yet minority communities. Do you think we're at a different place today when it comes to big energy projects? I mean, are they just too complicated given all the social and political environmental issues? And has environmental justice now maybe finally found its legs, so to speak, across these and other projects? What's your opinion on all of that?
Yeah, thank you. I'm really glad you asked that, and I'm grappling with that. And I do think that this is a really positive moment, a moment of reckoning, and a moment where we might be making an important pivot toward really embracing environmental justice, what others might call climate justice or even energy justice. The Atlantic Coast Pipeline, the Dakota Access Pipeline, for me, you know, a number of indigenous scholars and activists have pointed out that if you really, really want to address the crisis of sustainability and energy and climate on planet Earth, one surefire way to do that, and this may not be, you know, the alpha to omega and solve everything, but one surefire way to really transform that debate and discussion is to focus on what's happening with indigenous folks, with indigenous communities whose very lives, whose existence, whose sovereignties, whose territory, whose waters, whose sacred sites are being threatened by so many extraction and extractivist projects like these two pipelines. And if we address those issues facing indigenous folks, then virtually automatically, we will be improving the climate, we'll be improving the economy, the environment for the rest of us. And that's the same promise that Black Lives Matter has made. But to your specific question around, you know, has the debate shifted? I think it is shifting. And we're seeing it not only with the Dakota Access Pipeline, with the Atlantic Coast Pipeline, but we're also seeing it with the University of California system where I'm working, where just in the last 2 years, we saw the fossil-free University of California movement, that movement that sought to get the entire 10 campus system to divest from fossil fuels, achieve an enormous and unprecedented success. We got them to divest. Now, the devil's in the details. You can take a close look at the portfolio and find all sorts of leakiness and connections to fossil fuels. But overall, they have made this promise, the entire system of the University of California, to withdraw investments in fossil fuels. And to your point, to your question, the reason why, the rationale given by the regents of the University of California wasn't because, oh, we care about the climate, wasn't because, oh, these damn students have finally succeeded in pushing us to care and to put our money where our mouths are, but because these are financially risky and untenable and unsustainable investments from an economic standpoint.
Good. So let's stay with that, because I think it really goes to the heart of your studies to a degree, is that pipelines, whether they carry natural gas or oil or hydrogen, or it's a pipeline in the sky that's carrying electric current, they still tend to move where power and where resources are located back to places that people live. And so if we begin to attack all pipelines, it would be inevitable that one of two things happens. Either we don't have enough energy, or we need to locate these facilities much closer to where people live. So the EIA, their data suggests no one's really talking about conservation, right? No one's talking about reduced standards of living. They're talking about more and more consumption of energy, yet we continually find less ways to transport it. How do you square kind of standard of living, certainly the concept you've studied about environmental justice, not citing, you know, facilities next door to the people who are least able to defend against it. But how do you see that going, even in a world that's about solar and wind and hydrogen? Because those still, I mean, the Texas has the fields of wind, and they need to be moved by pipeline to Arizona, to Dallas, to Houston. How do you square growing an economy, increasing uses of energy, but eliminating, in fact, the ability to transport it?
Yeah, so I don't know that I've got a good answer to that extremely important question. I'll just speak to a couple aspects of that. I think that this question of quality of life and standard of living is one that I think in general, across the political class, whether you're, you know, Republican or Democrat, we've seen people on both sides of that aisle, I think, have agreement that we, at least in the United States, are not going to, and Obama himself said this, you know, I will not apologize for the American way of life. And I think much of the, and you know, I hesitate to say this, but I'll say it, much of the environmental movement, I think, in some ways agrees with that, that we are not going to fundamentally alter our way of life and our standard of living. What we want to do is just make it more sustainable, the sources of energy that are supporting us. And I actually have a real problem with that. I think that I'd say a couple things. One is, I think we do need to, many of us need to apologize for the American way of life, because it has brought untold violence and suffering amongst people the world over. Having said that, not all of us need to apologize for that. And that gets to the point of inequality. I mean, I know folks in certain communities that didn't have electricity or running water until a few years ago, and some that still don't. So, and this is in the United States of America, you know, so we don't have to go to the so-called third world or the global South outside the United States just to see an incredible disparity in the quote unquote American way of life. And for me, that always needs to be centered, because when we talk about sustainability, when we talk about consumption, conservation, at a local level, a national or a global level, we have to recognize that some of us simply are over-consuming, while others of us have never even had a chance to consume at a sustainable level. So we've got to recognize that and put that front and center. And I have to say, when it comes to energy consumption, something that frustrates the heck out of me, and you were just getting to this, I think, is that, yeah, we absolutely have to be talking about energy conservation and the reduction of consumption of energy use. There's just no path forward, no sustainable path forward, if we are not reducing energy consumption. Oftentimes with so-called energy transitions, we're not really seeing an energy transition. What we're seeing instead is an older industry, say fossil fuels, that is, you know, holding on to the very last drop, and maintaining that old legacy infrastructures until they can no longer do that. And that, of course, and they may buy up, like BP often says, oh, we're beyond petroleum. They want to have their cake and eat it both ways, right? Maintain that old fossil fuel driven and destructive industry, one step, one foot there, and then the other foot in more renewable energy, all under on a framework of infinite growth. And that's the last thing I'll say, that this idea of infinite growth is something that has to be challenged.
Thank you. I want to shift just a bit and begin to wrap up as we talk about environmental justice. And when I generally talk, I really like to talk about environmental justice in our world. And you've touched on so many things that those of us who think about low carbon fuels like propane, it really would say has been a staple of our industry. And serving the poor, serving the rural, serving those people who care about how to spend their paycheck. They still want to cook and heat their home, want to do it responsibly. Usually they live close to the land. And I think, you know, you go back to your roots in Tennessee, you would certainly see many homes have a propane tank there and living a relatively existence close to the land. But, you know, we think about now, one of the areas that we really bring social justice, environmental justice, climate change together is what we're doing with school buses, because the predominant method of fueling a school bus is a diesel fuel. And I think for all of us, we complete agreement that diesel fuel should be a thing of the past. It's toxic, it's dirty, it's not good for the community, it's not good for your lungs, it's good for no one. And so we're seeking cleaner ways to transport children to school. We now have the ability to transport them in buses that are fueled by propane, about one quarter of the cost of an electric school bus. And if we're really honest about where the grid gets its power today, much cleaner, certainly for NOx, for particulate matter, and even for greenhouse gases, than even electric today. So, you know, when I talk about environmental justice, I love to talk about the school bus situation, because we see what saving schools so much money. They migrate from diesel to propane. The other option would have been for them to migrate to electric, but we've saved them so much money under either scenario that now communities are able to deploy that money to really address things that I would argue that really matter. Better education, better housing, a whole suite of things. Where do you think we are perhaps missing the opportunity to be viewed as a bridge for still a place that's consumed by desire for clean climate and consumed by being correct in their treatment of indigenous people and, you know, disadvantaged communities?
Let me first start though by saying I totally agree with what you're saying about, you know, trying to transition away from diesel to cleaner fuels. And I'm reminded of the example of the group WEACT, the West Harlem Environmental Action Group, which is, you know, based in Harlem, New York, one of the most successful and impactful environmental justice groups anywhere in the country. And they did a great campaign around diesel buses in their community that were idling in various parts of the community. And they were documenting and demonstrating how that was negatively impacting people's respiratory health. And they came up with a plan to measure that, to sort of quantify that, and to work with the city of New York to phase those diesel buses out, and much more clean burning fuel was the result. And so that was, for me, that was a very positive example of what you're talking about. Just another case. What I would say is, I think the key from my perspective is the word you used, which is, you know, bridge, right? And yeah, to me, it's about transition. And I totally agree that, you know, whether you're an environmentalist or, you know, frankly, you know, somebody in much of the fossil fuel community where it feels like it's either my way or the highway, it's one way or the other. It's kind of these pure categories that are really unrealistic. And, you know, I consider myself a radical environmentalist, but, you know, I also believe that we need, if we're going to get to a sustainable future, it's got to be a transition. So, yeah. So that idea of a bridge to me makes a hell of a lot of sense. So for me, that's, you know, when I think about fossil fuel workers, right, and we talk about a just transition for those folks, right, millions of folks would be thrown out of work if we sort of had this, you know, this environmental fantasy of a green and clean and sustainable world. What do we do with them? And I've written an op-ed about the same thing with Black Lives Matter. It's like all the stuff about dismantling and defunding police departments. Why not come up with a plan for a just transition if we're going to go toward, at the very least, defunding or reducing funding for police departments, a just transition for law enforcement, right? We can't be throwing people out of work. And so for me, it always comes down to that, where we're whether we're talking about people who are in communities that are being polluted, who call themselves environmental justice activists, or people who are primarily worried about maintaining, you know, what I would call a toxic industry. Everybody, I think, has consensus that people need to put food on the table. And I think the way we put food on the table is to do what you're talking about, which is to make people understand and invite people to understand the importance of a transition and to really articulate what that could look like. And for me, that's really important here, because we had just recently a battle over a wind farm. And we got into that same old battle. It was like, well, yeah, wind farm's great. I love that. Let's support that. And then you take a closer look and it's like, well, labor groups were divided on it because it wasn't going to produce enough jobs. But one particular union was getting the jobs. And so they were in favor of it. Then we had Native Americans who were divided on it because one group saw it as a benefit to them economically. And another said, well, this is too close to our sacred sites. And of course the environmental community was divided. And I said, but at the very least, wouldn't we have been able to maybe not solve this problem, but address some of these issues by having this darn conversation at the very beginning, town hall meeting, whatever, and say, look, again, where are we now? Where do you want to be? What's the transition look like? And what are the difficulties? What are the devils in the details? And I think in the policy world, it's easy to just paper over that because you got to get something done. And other people are worried about their bottom line. But frankly, I just think it's not rocket science. It's harder than rocket science, right? We could put people on the moon. We can do that any day of the week, but bringing people together with different, you know, political views is a lot of work. But for me, it's the transition. And to me, that is so important. And that breaks that log jam of these absolutes and binaries. But I don't know how to do that. I'm still trying to figure that out.
We really tend to agree that environmental justice is truly generational, right? How do you think generationally, and I want to begin talking about even your students' views, but what do you think generationally about the issue of climate change?
We are seeing that, right? We've seen that for the last several years. People like Greta Thunberg, or Americans call her Greta Thunberg, the youth climate movement, the youth climate justice movement is in some ways the single most exciting and exhilarating example of social movement that has come along in a long time. And not only because they're young people, they are understanding that there's this generational gap. They're laying the blame for climate change on folks my age and older, which is exactly right. And saying that, you know, if we don't do the right thing, then we need to get out of the way and let them lead. I agree with that. The other thing that I find really exciting about this younger generation, and my students exemplify this as well, is that they demographically are, they represent the world. They represent America. It's a tapestry. It's a mosaic. It's super diverse. It's every color and race and creed that you can imagine, and every gender. And that's very different than the environmental movement of my generation or the generation before.
They really are different than the students of two decades ago, aren't they? They're certainly more intellectually prepared to contemplate some of those serious issues.
That's right.
Well, it's been a really interesting conversation, and I want to thank you for your time. One of the fun things we do with our guests here is we find a way to get a tree planted in a virtual forest, a national forest. We call it the Propane National Forest. And you're in California, so we have two forests that we love to ask our guests if they have a favorite. One's not far from Lake Tahoe, the El Dorado National Forest. The other is near Yosemite, the Sierra National Forest. We'd love to put a tree there in your name, but do you have a favorite of those two places?
You know, I've spent a little time in Yosemite, so that one there might work for me.
Well, that's great. I wish we'd have thought about a forest in your native Tennessee, because there's certainly some beautiful places there, but we'll find a place in Sierra National Forest for you. I want to thank you for being with us. I want to thank you for really your attention to this matter and for sharing great views with us. Congratulations on your book that's just come out. And just thank you for taking time with me to be on this Path to Zero.
Thank you so much, Tucker. I really enjoyed every moment of it. Thanks for all the good work you do.
Well, thank you. And thank you all of you for taking the time with us today on Path to Zero.
This has been Path to Zero with Tucker Perkins. Subscribe and learn more at cleanamericanenergy.us. And if you like what you have heard, rate us on whatever platform you use to listen to your podcasts.